Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents America's Youngest Ambassador, The Cold War Story of Samantha Smith's Lasting Message of Peace by Lena Nelson, narrated by Krista Lewis. We love and lose in China. We weep on England's moors, and laugh and moan in Guinea, and thrive on Spanish shores. We seek success in Finland, are born and die in Maine. In minor ways we differ. In major, we're the same. I note the obvious differences between each sort and type, but we are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike. We are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike. From Human Family, a poem by Maya Angelou. Prologue. On August 28, 1985, the pews at St. Mary's Church in Augusta, Maine were filling up quickly. When a black limousine pulled up to its doors and a tall man in his 30s stepped out, reporters closed ranks around him on the church steps. The man's name was Vladimir Kulagin, and he was the first secretary for cultural affairs at the Soviet Embassy in Washington, D.C. Kulagin had obtained a special clearance from the State Department to travel to Kennebec County, one of the 10 main counties that were off-limits to Soviet citizens in the summer of 1985. This concession, a rare pause in the Soviet-American conflict, was granted so that Kulagin could attend a memorial service for a 13-year-old American schoolgirl, Samantha Smith, and her father Arthur, who had been killed in a plane crash near Auburn, Maine, just 3 days earlier. Kulagin paused and turned to the microphones. She was like a ray of sunshine with her smile, her frankness, openness, her friendship. We saw her, this small girl, as a big, great ambassador, you know, and millions of Soviet people judged the American people by her. 2 days earlier, on the evening of August 26, 1985, on the other side of the world, I was packing my school bag, wondering what the fourth grade would be like. Every school year in the Soviet Union started on the same day, September 1st, my birthday. This one would be my 10th. I largely ignored the cacophony of the evening news broadcast on our black and white TV until it was suddenly interrupted by the commentator's somber voice. "The terrible news has just crossed the ocean. Samantha Smith is no more." I turned to the TV and froze. I'd never met Samantha Smith. The little girl from the tiny Maine town of Manchester lived too far away from my Soviet hometown of Arkhangelsk. She only smiled at me from my TV screen and photographs in the newspapers as she and her family toured my country in the summer of 1983. Yet in that moment, when I heard that she and her father had died in a plane crash in Maine, the fragility of life became very real to me. I don't remember whether I lowered my school notebook into my bag or carried it to the couch where I sat for a while, stunned. Where had she been going? And where was she coming from? I imagined the crash, the plane, falling from the sky. Did she know what was happening? Or maybe she had been asleep. "Yesterday, when I went to my friend's house, she might have been packing her suitcase," I said to no one in particular. I found this rewind comforting, and so I retraced my own steps back in time and imagined what yesterday might have been like for her, grasping at the moments to which I was not privy, but which held her smiling, alive. 21 years later, on a waning afternoon in August 2006, I followed Jane Smith out of the Maine State Museum to the bronze statue of her only child. Lush birch trees filtered the weary rays of sunshine on the likeness of a little girl with shoulder-length hair and a toothy grin. The girl, dressed in a polo shirt, jeans, and tennis shoes, held a peace dove in her outstretched hands. A bear cub, a symbol of both Maine and Russia, sat at her feet. "I used to buy those polo shirts at Sears," Jane said. You know, sometimes in the winter, I think that she might be cold out here. Technically, this is not my first attempt to record the remarkable story of Samantha Smith. On hearing the news of her tragic death, I wanted to do something to preserve her memory, so I started a collection of newspaper clippings about her from as many Soviet newspapers as I could locate. I glued my findings into school notebooks, and by the time I was 12, my collection fit into 7 of them. Then I got the brilliant idea of binding them into a book. I asked my mom whether she or any of her friends knew anything about bookbinding. On learning that they did not, I embarked on the project on my own. Taking apart an old math textbook, I imitated its design. I used 2 large pieces of cardboard for the book covers and the book spine. I maneuvered my scissors to carefully cut the brown vinyl my mom had procured from her co-workers and folded it neatly over the covers. For several hours, I holed up in my family's only bathroom, using a washing machine as a workbench. Finally, my finished project, a thick brown scrapbook, was ready to be set under a stack of textbooks to dry flat. While not aesthetically pleasing, it was very functional and kept my entire collection together. 30-some years later, it still sits on my bookshelf. It was among the few items that I brought along in my suitcase when, in 1995, I moved to the United States after getting married. I looked through that scrapbook again with my mother when she came to visit me in 2003, and we talked about my late grandmother, Baba Valia, who had been a great fan of Samantha Smith. I was 7 when Baba Valia showed me the newspaper article with the letter Samantha had written to our Soviet leader, Yuri Andropov. She called her Samantka, since Russian doesn't have a TH sound. Baba Valia held the 10-year-old American in high esteem, reprimanding me with, "Samantka wouldn't do that," if I misbehaved. She felt that Samantha Smith was an example worth following. That evening, after my mom went to bed, I typed Samantha Smith into my online search engine. I was shocked to discover that a story that once had such wide news coverage on both sides of the ocean had no online presence. Except for a short mention on a U.S.-Russian sister city page of the Samantha Smith Foundation, started by Samantha's mother Jane after her daughter's death, there was nothing to be found about Samantha Smith. How could this be? How could she have been forgotten? Someone should make a website about her, I thought to myself. But I had no idea how to make a website. So instead, the next morning I wrote a letter. Very Samantha-like, I suppose. I used the contact info for the Samantha Smith Foundation and addressed the envelope to her mother, Jane Smith. I told her that her daughter was my childhood hero and thanked her for Samantha. A couple weeks later, a trip to the mailbox revealed an envelope with a return address that read J. Smith. I stood staring at it for a while. An answer I never expected to receive made me feel strangely connected to my childhood. I opened the envelope as I walked down the hill to my house. "Your story is very interesting to me," Jane wrote, "and helpful. To know what Samantha's adventure meant to you." Jane asked me whether I knew that Portland, Maine, was a sister city with my hometown of Arkhangelsk. I don't know why she wrote back to me. Good manners, I suppose. But I knew then that I would need to figure out how to make that website. I had no idea that a letter I didn't expect to get an answer to would be the start of an adventure of my own. It took me 2 years to get started with web design, but in May 2005, when my family caught a flu bug and, for 2 weeks, asked only for snacks and water, I finally figured out how to use a website template, and www.samanthasmith.info went live. That summer, I was planning to be on the East Coast, so I contacted Jane again to ask whether it would be possible to meet her and shake her hand. "Yes," she replied. "Let's meet at the statue in Augusta." In August of that year, along with my 7-year-old son and 4-year-old daughter, my husband, and my mother, I stood looking up at a bronze statue of a smiling girl holding a dove in her hands. A few minutes later, I saw Jane. I recognized her by her walk, which I'd seen on TV when I was little. Fast, determined, she walked up the hill from the parking lot and came up to me with her hand outstretched. I stretched out mine. Jane was remarkably friendly to a complete stranger. We chatted about the kids' interests. She commented on how my mother and I looked alike. "So do you and your daughter," replied my mom, pointing at the statue. We took a picture together. A month or so later, I told Jane about the website I had made. She loved it turned out. She had wanted to make one for years, she said, but hadn't known how. As I watched the website traffic grow, emails from around the world began to arrive regularly, with tributes as well as scans of news clippings. Many of the senders were my contemporaries who had scrapbooks just like mine. Some offered help with translating articles, others with digitizing videos. As years passed, images from my site spread around the internet, and then the American and Russian news agencies uploaded their own photographs of Samantha's trip. Long forgotten, they finally were back on display. In 2007, the U.S. Embassy in Russia included an article about Samantha on its History of Soviet-American Relations page. Most rewarding, though, were the emails from schoolchildren who had questions about Samantha for their National History Day projects. As I scoured the now-defunct Google newspaper archive late into the night, I kept asking myself why I was so determined to preserve this particular story now that the Cold War was over. It seemed to me back then that correcting the injustice of Samantha's story being forgotten was somehow important. "History is fickle," a friend of mine, a former war correspondent, once said. "Out of it we pull the tiny kernels that touched us in a singular way. Whatever we take the time to remember will be remembered after us. The rest will be lost." The story of Samantha Smith touched me in that singular way. Hence, I will take the time to remember. Samantha Reed Smith was born on June 29, 1972, in Holton, Maine. I was born 3 years later in Arkhangelsk, a northern port city of the Soviet Union. I've never thought of us as we. And yet, we were two girls who lived on different sides of the ocean at a time when our two countries were each other's greatest enemies. Part 1. Letter. In June 2014, Russia's Federal Archives marked the 100th birthday of Yuri Andropov with an exhibition of declassified documents detailing the reticent Soviet leader's life. Among the transcripts of the Politburo meetings and the General Secretary's correspondence with the heads of state was a letter from President Ronald Reagan congratulating him on his election to the post of chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Next to it was a letter penned on yellow notepaper in a careful, childish scrawl. It was signed, "Samantha Smith, P.S. Please write back." 1. Mourning Ribbons. November 1982, Arkhangelsk, USSR. I was 7 years old when Leonid Brezhnev died at 8:30 a.m. on November 10, 1982, at his dacha on the outskirts of Moscow. His death at the age of 75, and with it the end of his 18-year rule, weren't reported until the next day, when all the Soviet radio stations played solemn music and the announcer's grave voice read the news at 10 a.m. Thursday, November 11th, started as just another school day. Our homeroom teacher, Nina Mikhailovna, taught all the first grade subjects, from math to arts, in our third floor classroom at Arkhangelsk School number 21. A mother of three, she was a strict but kind lady in her early 40s. Her short blonde curls fell gracefully over her ears, and she had a beautiful smile, when she felt like smiling. Around midday that day, it took longer than usual to get going with instructions for the next task. Nina Mikhailovna surveyed the class, and then in a very formal voice, she said she had some very sad news. The General Secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Leonid Ilyich Brezhnev, had died a sudden death. I was confused by the sudden part. The word in Russian literally meant that death had sneaked up on him. But how could this happen to someone so important? Wasn't someone supposed to know that he was sick and could die? The fact that he was gone and that I should be grieving didn't really register. Nina Mikhailovna's demeanor was somber, and I could tell that she expected us to follow suit. Somewhat unprepared for the mood, I lowered my eyes to stare at my notebook. "Find the portrait of Leonid Ilyich toward the back of your textbook," she instructed us. The rustle of pages spread across the classroom as we located the image. In the textbook, he looked younger than the man I frequently saw on the huge posters of Politburo members that my mom's co-workers carried during the October Revolution Day or International Workers' Day parades. The black and white portraits, nailed to long sticks, were handed to people in the parade on those government holidays. The tall men in fedora hats distributing them would ask jokingly, "Who wants to carry Gromyko? Ustinov, anyone?" I sensed a degree of contempt in their remarks, but at a young age I didn't quite understand all that it meant. Sometimes I saw those men in the portraits on my black and white TV. They used big words strung into very long sentences. I wondered how they could say so much, and yet I understood so little. Pravdist, the tiny bookstore on my street corner, which I checked regularly for postcards with drawings of bears and hedgehogs, also had a large portrait of Brezhnev on its wall. In all his portraits, Brezhnev reminded me of a big, silent bear, and I found his sagging mouth funny, a notion I didn't share with anyone, somehow sensing its inappropriateness. Brezhnev in my textbook seemed to crack a slight smile. He was wearing a dark suit, his shoulders so large they disappeared past the margins of the frame. Four gold stars adorned the left side of his chest, and four round medals graced the right. He wore a small red flag pin on his left lapel. He must have been a real war hero to get so many awards, I concluded as I counted them. "Get out your rulers," said Nina Mikhailovna. "Find your black pencils." I lifted the lid of my orange plastic pencil box to reveal a set of colored pencils. Locating the black one, I sat ready for the next set of instructions. In the lower right corner of the page, you will make two diagonal lines to form a black mourning ribbon, just like the black ribbons you will see everywhere today when you go home. I had seen the mourning ribbons before at the houses of my friends who had lost a grandparent. A black silk ribbon stretching across the lower right corner of a photograph for some reason made me look at the image longer than usual, compelling me to imagine their loss. With a piece of white chalk, Nina Mikhailovna made a large rectangle on the blackboard and then carefully marked the lower right corner with two diagonal lines. She stepped back to show us. The black of the board between the two white chalk lines did indeed look like a mourning ribbon. It made no sense to me to use a ruler for art, but I feared that freehanding a ribbon on such a day was out of the question. Despite my best efforts at manipulating the ruler, my 7-year-old hands couldn't manage a perfect ribbon. When Nina Mikhailovna walked around to inspect our work, I casually rested the brown sleeve of my school dress to cover up the crookedness of my mourning ribbon. "Now," Nina Mikhailovna said, back at the blackboard. Her eyes settled on slender Katya Kozlova, who sat across the aisle from me. Already the shortest girl in our class, Katya looked even smaller in her brown school dress and black apron. Her braids, crisscrossed at the back of her head, almost managed to control her unruly curls, just a tiny bit of the dandelion-like fuzz gathered around her brows. In class, Katya was studious, but her sweet nature made her a cheerful companion at breaks. "Would you please read to us what it says, Katya?" Nina Mikhailovna instructed. Katya nodded in response. "Everyone, follow along as Katya reads." Katya started reading the four lines of text under the portrait. "Leonid Ilyich Brezhnev, the General Secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union." Those big words had way too many syllables. Only 2 months into the first grade, I had a hard time navigating the lines. My finger followed aimlessly, my eyes unable to form words at Katya's speed. I was grateful that Nina Mikhailovna hadn't asked me. Unlike Katya and some of my other classmates who read well before entering school, I was among those students whose parents, for one reason or another, felt that reading was learned in the classroom. I suspected Nina Mikhailovna realized that this was no occasion for sounding out syllables. My finger hunted for white spaces where a pause might indicate Katya's location. At one point, the pause seemed too long. Did she trip on that big word? Or maybe this one? My finger rested in the middle of line 3. I snuck a glance at her. She was crying. Quiet sobs at first, followed by loud sniffling. Nina Mikhailovna seemed at a loss for words and willing to wait. Katya pulled a handkerchief out of her pocket and tried to continue, but sobs overpowered her again. Why would anyone cry because they didn't know how to read a word? I thought to myself. Suddenly it hit me. Katya knew how to read those words. She knew how to read all of them. She was sad that he had died. I felt ashamed. I couldn't push a tear out even if I tried. I looked at Katya again. She wiped her nose. With some effort, she finished reading. "Chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR." The four lines of text were his title. I scanned it again, for the first time realizing the scale of grief I was supposed to feel. "Now look at the page on the right," said Nina Mikhailovna. On it, 5 children in colorful folk costumes were walking hand in hand. "Leonid Ilyich stood for peace," Nina Mikhailovna said. "Katya, can you continue?" Katya composed herself and turned to read the text under the picture. "Children of many nationalities live on this blue planet we call Earth. They might have different skin color. They might speak different languages. But all of them wish for happiness and bright, sunlit sky. Soviet children want to be friends with the children all over the world and work for peace. Children of many lands, we all live with a dream of peace." Why am I not sad? I asked myself over and over, but no answer came to me. I made a mental note to discuss my lack of sadness with Baba Valia, my grandma, when I got home. I was worried that maybe in my preschool upbringing, I had missed out on something else besides reading. School got out early that day. On the tram ride home, I noted the ever-growing number of Soviet red flags going up around town. Black ribbons were attached to their tips. When I got off the tram and walked to my apartment, I saw that Pravdist also had a flag installed on its corner. It was blowing in the wind, a black ribbon skimming over its redness. For a moment, I felt that the black ribbons might eventually make me sad. I ran around the corner of my apartment building, a 5-story structure lovingly known to its inhabitants as the Sleeping Skyscraper, because of the multitude of its entrances and the sheer mass of brick that sprawled over the entire block. The Sleeping Skyscraper was built using a Khrushchevka plan, named for Nikita Khrushchev, who had visited the northern port of Arkhangelsk in 1962 and decried the dismal living conditions in the wooden communal apartments. Studios and 1-bedroom apartments in the Sleeping Skyscraper had indoor plumbing and running water. By 1982, our 474-square-foot 1-bedroom apartment housed my mom, Baba Valia, my younger brother and sister, myself, and our dog, a white Balinese named Jacques. I opened the heavy door of our entrance, ran up the first flight of stairs, and stopped at the row of blue mailboxes. I stuck my pinky into the tiny round slot of mailbox number 10 to check for mail. There was none. Baba Valya must have picked it up already, I thought, as I hopped up the concrete stairs to the third floor. I rang the doorbell, and Baba Valya opened the door. The white fluff ball that was Jacques flew out from under her feet and jumped up and down until I petted him. Baba Valya had moved to the sleeping skyscraper right after my parents' divorce in December 1980. With her arrival came hot lunches that filled the house with tummy-warming aromas, folded laundry, shoes neatly lined up in the hallway, and fairy tales at night, for me and my brother and sister. The taut gray curls of Baba Valya's perm bounced energetically as she quickly moved around our small apartment, always fetching something for one of us. "Did you see all the black ribbons?" I asked. "Yes, they always do that when the leader dies," Baba Valya said matter-of-factly, as if she knew that we all eventually become privy to the sacred ritual of a leader's death. In the kitchen, I dug in my school bag and pulled out my textbook to show Baba Valya my crooked black ribbon over Brezhnev's portrait. "I messed up the ribbon," I said. "But you know what? Katya Kozlova cried when the teacher asked her to read about Leonid Ilyich Brezhnev today, but I didn't, I just couldn't, and I felt bad. Why didn't I?" I searched for a hint of a reprimand in her deep gray eyes, but there was none. "Well, I guess you had nothing to cry about," Baba Valya said thoughtfully. Even back then, when the contours of the reality that was my life were only coming into view, I sensed a certain aloofness in Baba Valya's attitude toward the government. It was as if she understood that things she couldn't do anything about, she had to let alone. She reflected seriously on only one topic, the war. In the summer of 1942, when German planes bombed Arkhangelsk, Baba Valya was 23. She spent the white summer nights dragging heavy buckets of sand up to the town's roofs and tossed the sand to snuff out the glistening lights of the incendiary bombs that Nazi Germans dropped on the city by the thousands. The wooden walkways of Arkhangelsk were swallowed by a rushing river of fire. Bread was rationed in tiny squares. That was why she still gathered all the breadcrumbs on the kitchen table by gently licking her finger and then picking them off the vinyl tablecloth. Peck, 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 her fingers would go as sweetbread disappeared on her tongue. "So who will be our leader now?" I asked. "I don't know," she said, "but they will publish it in the newspaper soon." A large portrait of Brezhnev covered a quarter of the front page of the next morning's paper. My mom scanned the front page. "Well, people are saying that Andropov might be the next in line. His name is listed first on the funeral organizing committee." It was raining that day, and even when it stopped the next day, I stayed home, worried that it might be wrong to play outside. On the morning of November 13th, the papers published the picture of the new leader. He had white hair, big glasses, and only one star on his black coat. The large letters under his picture read, "Yuri Vladimirovich Andropov." I decided that I needed to remember the name of this new leader. I was not sure whether this was to cover for my lack of sadness about the passing of the previous one or just a conscious step to take my education into my own hands. The memorizing proved easy. Yuri was the name of the first Soviet cosmonaut, Gagarin. Vladimirovich was a patronymic derivative of Lenin's first name, Vladimir, and Andropov was only one letter different from the last name of my great-aunt, Antropov. And just in case, I had three more days to practice before school started. Leonid Ilyich Brezhnev was buried 2 days later on November 15th, 1982, near the Kremlin Wall, in a lavish state funeral. His many awards, fastened to crimson silk pillows, were carried by high military officers who marched with his coffin to his burial site in Red Square. Many world leaders sent their representatives or attended the funeral personally. For 5 minutes, all the factories and offices in the Soviet Union stopped to mourn his passing.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?